Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
This is Tom Hartman.
Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, here's Tom Hartman.
If you haven't figured it out by now. And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Oh, my. Iran has fired off a bunch of missiles. They didn't announce that their range could reach Israel, but they could. 1,200 miles. It's got quite a lot of folks very concerned. We'll get into that as we continue through the day. John McCain, the campaign rolling along. There's actually interesting new device that is being evaluated, apparently, by the Department of Homeland Security. For airline security that I know you're going to want to know about. We'll tell you about that. And much other in the news. But first, one of the perennial issues in American history, and I mean literally a perennial issue in American history, going back to Thomas Jefferson, for example. In 1813, it was a couple of years after he left the presidency, on June 18th, Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter to his old friend James Monroe. He said, "It is more a subject of joy that we have so few of the desperate characters which compose modern armies. It proves more forcibly the necessity of obliging every citizen to be a soldier. This was the case of the Greeks and Romans, and must be that of every free state. Where there is no oppression, there will be no pauper hirelings." His whole point, he was morally offended by this, and his whole point was that basically volunteer armies depend on what he referred to as the pauper class for their existence. And in fact, he said, this is in a September 10th, 1814 letter to his friend Dr. Thomas Cooper, "Our men are so happy at home that they will not hire themselves to be shot at for a shilling a day. Hence we can have no standing armies for defense because we have no paupers to furnish the materials." And then in 1805, when he was president, he said that he proposed to Congress in 1805 and subsequently on the last trial was lost by, I believe, a single vote only, a system of universal national service. Had it prevailed, what has now happened in the War of 1812 would not have happened. Instead of burning our capital, we should have possessed theirs in Montreal and Quebec. We must now adopt it and we'll be safe. And he noted that he had three quarters of a million men who qualified for the draft in 1814 and said, quote, "With this force properly classed, organized, trained, armed, and subject to tours of a year of military duty, we have no more fear of our defense from our country than those who have resources of despotism and pauperism." Jonah Goldberg is on the line. He is the contributing editor of National Review, founding editor of National Review Online, author of Liberal Fascism. Is that the last? Yeah, Liberal Fascism. Last time we talked about this, Jonah, welcome back.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
And JonahGoldberg.net, of course, the website. Jonah, you have written an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times in which you're suggesting that a national service program, you hear Jefferson is saying, do away with the standing armies and have every person be a member of a local militia, basically an entire national draft for all men between the ages of 17 and 49. We've had drafts at various times in the history of the United States, but I haven't done a census, but many of the fully developed countries around the world, Germany, Denmark, France, many of them, Israel, require a year of, if not military service, work, Peace Corps service, work with hospitals after graduating from high school. You're claiming that Barack Obama's support of this means that he's supporting slavery. John McCain, by the way, is also supporting something similar to this.
Yeah, as I freely admit, first of all, I don't say it's slavery. I say it's involuntary servitude, which is also prescribed by the 13th Amendment. And I think And I fully admit that John McCain is, if not as bad, then worse than Obama on this stuff. But Obama gave the news peg speech.
Involuntary servitude, as defined by the 13th Amendment, was slavery. I mean, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed after the Civil War to end slavery. It had absolutely nothing to do with the military draft. In fact, when the 13th Amendment was passed, there was a military draft in place.
Yeah, that's fine. Let's be honest about it. The 13th Amendment mentioned slavery and involuntary servitude as different things. If they were completely redundant, they wouldn't have listed them as separate things. There were all sorts of other kinds of involuntary servitude. I am not against the draft when the draft is necessary. I think that the draft is evil, but it can be a necessary evil.
Well, here's the reason why I think that we should have a military draft. Number one, it would provide more diversity for our military. This was the thing that Jefferson was concerned about, is that military elite classes tend to be the types who end up rising up and overthrowing governments. That's where you get your military coups from, number one. Number two, you end up with what Jefferson identified as the pauper class being the place from which much of the military is drawn. In other words, the military becomes the employer of last resort. If you pull our military employees and our so-called contractors out of our unemployment figures, we're looking at massive unemployment in the United States, and that, which is, by the way, the way that they used to calculate it back in the day. And number three, if you don't, if you have a national service rather than a volunteer army, in quotes, then you're much more likely to have, since everybody's child may end up serving in the military, you would be much less likely to have the kind of disastrous events like the Iraq War that you were so supportive of that has destroyed America's military and is destroying our reputation all around the world.
Yeah, and I think there's a little hyperbole in there, but I think you make a perfectly fine point when you say that Americans would be less likely to go to war if there was a draft. And I think that may be, you know, one of the many.
What is possibly wrong with that?
I didn't say there's anything possibly wrong with it. There are lots of good things that come with the draft, but that doesn't mean the draft isn't evil. Forcibly requiring people to kill people or to risk their lives against their will is not a good thing.
No, and I'm not in favor of that. I'm in favor of a year of national service. You can choose whether that national service is going to be military or whether you're going to work in a hospital or work in a group home or care for the elderly or go out and rebuild the national forest. I don't care, but I think a year of national service.
You still think the government should force you to do it?
Yeah, just like I think that the government forces you to stop at red lights in traffic lights. I just like the government forces you to pay for the taxes that all of us use to pay for public education. There are some things that are just public goods.
As
a free society, we collectively agree that, yes, we're going to pay for that. If you want to call that force, that's fine. I'll agree with it.
Well, it's objectively so that it's force, you know, and it seems to me that the classical liberal understanding that's reflected in people like Jefferson about the nature of our republic is that the government forces people to do things only when it is absolutely necessary to protect the public order.
Then why did Jefferson support a national draft forever?
He found it necessary. It's entirely possible that Jefferson was wrong. I find it amazing how, you know, liberals who invoke the living Constitution and say the times have changed, you know, so the Second Amendment is obsolete and all these sorts of things, now all of a sudden you're quoting back Jefferson to me on the draft as if that's scripture. I don't see that way at all. Lots of things have changed. The idea that a professional army today is inclined towards coup-like behavior, I find offensive.
I think it's already happened. I think it's exactly what we were warned about by Dwight Eisenhower, the military-industrial complex. You've got hundreds of millions of dollars being passed from the military-industrial complex back to politicians, not the least of which is Dick Cheney and all his buddies. I mean, Dick Cheney's, you know, former oil company now has made so much money and engaged in so much criminal activity that they're moving, in my opinion, to another country where they only have to keep records for a year. And, you know, some suggesting
if you want to have a sort of, you know, conspiracy theory argument about whether Halliburton is the root of all evil and whether or not the industrial
You're suggesting there's no war profiteering going on, Jonah Goldberg?
There may or may not be, but it is all a bunch of hot air distraction from the question at hand about whether or not the government has the right to force free citizens to clean up the sides of roads and work as candy stripers. That is involuntary servitude, and I think it's wrong. I think it's necessary for the draft. It's necessary for the draft because the country is at war. The idea that to use it as a social engineering tool to recruit, to force kids, force young people to work at the government's bidding, at what the government deems important, is ludicrous.
So you want to just sit back and go down to Starbucks and have your latte and have your and enjoy your nice meal and just say, oh yeah, I'm going to enjoy the society, free public education I got, yeah, it's great, yeah, free public highways, yes, all the modern wonders of American society, but I'm not going to give back anything to my damn country. That's your opinion. No, what you're saying is that you don't give a damn about the country, that you don't think that young people should serve their nation.
Yeah, that's wonderful, but you got to keep in mind.
No, you're saying it's not. You're saying it's involuntary servitude.
No, Tom, I'm saying that people serve their nation more because they're not forced to do it. These countries that you invoke that have mandatory servitude actually have less volunteerism, less serving their nation because they require that stuff. In America, we volunteer more than those countries. But you don't think anything is legitimate.
And I would submit to you that in those countries, there's a lot less jingoism. There's a lot less of this phony patriotism of, oh, yeah, I'm all in favor of the troops, but I don't want to become one of them.
Forcing everybody to do the government's bidding for a year or two will solve all of
JonahGoldberg.net. Thanks a lot, Jonah.
This is Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Truth in Broadcasting.
On vacation all the summer long, doing some intense relaxing just to keep our country strong. I've been seeing Condoleezza, Donald Rumsfeld too. Fox News said I'm still the greatest, so I guess it must be true. Iraq is going well, liberal doesn't sell, Bolton's in New York. I sit back and beam, Roberts is supreme, my revenge for Bork. Someone's been removing some brushweed,
and
that someone
thank you,
is me.
Welcome back, someone's 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And Americans, this Barack Obama's plan. This is what has Jonah Goldberg's, you know, panties in a wad. He has him all upset, and I don't mean that in a dismissive way. I understand the libertarian position. I, me, nobody else. Right? I get it. You know, libertarians. You know, there is no such thing as a social compact. We're not in all this together. Anyhow, here's from Barack Obama's website. In the area where you go over to issues and you talk about service, he says the problem. Americans were not asked to serve after 9/11. President Bush squandered an opportunity to mobilize the American people following 9/11 when he asked Americans only to go shopping. There's not some federal support for service. He says while more than 500,000 people have served in AmeriCorps, the program turns away tens of thousands of applicants a year because of limited funding. And need for more R&D in the nonprofit sector. He talks about enabling Corporation for National and Community Service. He wants to expand AmeriCorps from 75,000 slots to 250,000. He wants to engage retired Americans, expand the Peace Corps, show the best face of America, expand the youth building program, expand service learning in our schools, require 100 hours of service in college. Obama will establish a new American Opportunity Tax Credit that's worth $4,000 a year in exchange for 100 hours of public service a year. 100 hours of public service. You know, I'm saying we should go and have a year of a draft or national service. And you know, Obama's saying 100 hours a year and we'll give you $4,000 for college. I mean, this has conservatives saying that he's in favor of slavery or, excuse me, involuntary servitude. I'll give you the exact quote, actually. From Jonah Goldberg. There's a weird irony at work when Senator Barack Obama, the black presidential candidate who allegedly scrubbed the stain of racism from the nation, vows to run afoul of the constitutional amendment that abolished slavery. Come on. By the way, there are so many other things going on as well. I also want to, this Jonathan Turley last night was on Countdown. Keith Olbermann's normally hosting it. Rachel Maddow has been guest hosting all this week and doing a great job of it. And Jonathan Turley, constitutional scholar, professor of constitutional law at George Washington University. And he pointed out this inconvenient truth. This is really worth noting.
You know, there was a recent judgment just a few days ago in the El Harriman case where a federal judge said, obviously the president committed an illegal act. That illegal act is defined as a felony, a crime, under federal law.
Now, we're talking about wiretapping people, spying on people. This goes back to the FISA law that presumably is being voted on today in the Senate.
So what the Democrats are doing here with the White House is they're trying to conceal a crime that is hiding in plain view, that everyone can see it. And so the argument for it is quite simple. Nobody wants to have a confrontation over the fact that the president committed a felony, not once, but at least 30 times. That's a very inconvenient fact right now in Washington.
So another reason to add to the conspiracy theory of why is it that the Democrats are supporting this so-called FISA legislation. FISA is actually there and intact. It's always been there. It hasn't gone away. It's not going away. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that works just fine. There's one small problem with it. It needs to be amended so that if foreign-to-foreign telephone conversations happen to route through a switching system in the United States, that there's not a warrant isn't necessary to check on them, because the warrant is only necessary for people in the United States. Okay, so that one small technical fix could have been made with a piece of legislation that was just a paragraph. Could have been done that way. Instead, it's let's give away the farm and let's tear up the Fourth Amendment. So what is it? Is it that the telecom companies are carpet bombing the Congress with money? Well, yeah, they passed out some $15 million. Are they calling in political favors like crazy? Possibly. Number two, is it possible that they've been wiretapping us since before 9/11? As I believe it was Joe Nocio, the chairman of Quest Communications, said that in February of 2001, and his company ended up not getting all those juicy federal contracts, and he ended up going to jail. Is it for other things, for other corruption? Tell me, a CEO of a major corporation who isn't, couldn't, if they really wanted to get him, couldn't be gotten in any case. He said it was February 2001, a month after Bush was installed in office by the Supreme Court, that they were asking the phone companies to listen in on you and me, to wiretap our phones illegally. Or is it that the Democrats know that if they don't pass this FISA legislation, that public service organizations, the ACLU, people like People for the American Way, people like, Bobby Kennedy's group, lawyers out there, class action lawsuits are going to bust this thing wide open and prove that George Bush committed crimes, actual felonies, as Jonathan Turley says, at least 30 different times, a felony that calls for each one 2 years in prison. And that certainly would rise to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors worthy of impeachment, and that's a topic that the Democrats just don't want to discuss. What is it? 27 minutes past the hour. National service, impeachment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
We're going to get active 34 minutes past the hour. For example, speaking of active, Brave New Films and other activists are delivering a petition today with 43,000 signatures asking that Joe Lieberman be stripped of his committee chairmanship. They're delivering these to the Senate Democratic Steering and Outreach Committee at 11 o'clock. Well, actually, 11 o'clock Eastern time. That would have been about an hour ago. So, or about 40 minutes ago. So that is happening. And tip of the hat to Robert Greenwald and all the great folks at Brave New Worlds, a marvelous thing that they're doing. And Mark Penn and Karen Hughes, who failed to market Bush's policies to the Muslim and Arab world. Remember that whole thing? She was going to go out there and tell them how wonderful the American way is, and they kind of laughed at her, and she went home with a tail between her tail, or legs, rather, whatever the metaphor is. And Mark Penn, same deal. He was running the Hillary Clinton campaign, and most people figure he's the one who really screwed it up. They've decided to go into business together to advise corporations who are in a crisis. Yeah, let's make money in the private sector. That's 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Colin in Pecos, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. Hey, Colin, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. It's so nice to speak to such a gentleman and a scholar.
Thank you.
And I wanted to say, you know, that if it's a voluntary program, there's no way that Jonah can ever put that against the 13th Amendment, whereas mandatory buying into health insurance arguably is, because the money's not going into the Treasury, the money's going to private corporations.
Well, how about mandatory car insurance?
Yep. I'll be a little bit libertarian on that one.
Although you can choose not to own a car. I mean, you know, that's I think that it's entirely appropriate that we require people to have car insurance, or that we collectively have some sort of car insurance, because you go out in the public highways, and if something happens, there needs to be some insurance someplace, somehow.
Right. But that'll hit on my libertarian streak there, which is very small. But on the other hand, I did want to say that I think that it's very dangerous that government mandate the parameters of service.
Right.
In my personal experience, you know, my service to the country, other than being a member of the Young Adult Conservation Corps before that was waxed, was that I was very active getting busted with Ellsberg and Ginsburg and all of those guys at Rocky Flats, and I spent a couple of years crisscrossing the country protesting, you know, the nuclear weapons program and nuclear energy as a whole. And I think Three Mile Island was proof, and the legislation passed subsequently, that was proof of service, which was completely contrary to the Carter administration.
Yeah.
And in government as a whole, then. So I think it's very important that we never mandate what service to our country is, and that true patriotism is when people have a true belief in perhaps even going against the administration or the current government.
Yeah, respectfully, I'm going to disagree with you on the latter, Colin. And I'm, at the same time, I want to absolutely honor what you did and say, you know, I think that you are a true patriot, and it's marvelous what you did crisscrossing the country on behalf of anti-nuclear and peace causes. God bless you. It's absolutely marvelous. And I would say that here's an opportunity. I mean, If people have to serve a year after high school graduation, it provides that psychologically necessary rite of passage that we no longer have in our society. I mean, it accomplishes so many positive things. It's one of the reasons why so many countries do it. And one of the things that you could serve in is an organization that's working for peace. And if the military is no longer all voluntary, you're going to have a military that's far less likely to say, yes, sir, we will happily go off and bomb and kill those people no matter what the reason. You know, there's going to be a much healthier degree of skepticism in the United States, and I see that as a good thing. Rich in Birmingham, Alabama, you want to disagree with me?
Well, yeah, just two quick points, Tom. I'm somebody that's always had a service-oriented career. It's the only kind of job I will ever have. And I put a high value on service. And I would love to see groups like the Peace Corps rank swell, because they do a lot of good, and it gives people in this country, which we need, an international perspective. But I think it has to be voluntary. I wouldn't be opposed to linking it with college. You know, I think AmeriCorps ought to be reverse, perhaps 2 years of service for 4 years of college.
Yeah, that's the sort of thing, you know, Barack Obama is basically proposing is, 50 or 100 hours of service gets you $4,000 for college. You know, it's a pretty good deal.
I think that is a good deal, and making college more accessible and helping other people. But with the military, you know, if as a free person, if I've got any freedoms, it should be the right to decide if I'm willing to kill or die, the two most important things human beings can do, for a cause. And that's the reason. And
well, that's why I agree that, you know, I agree with you on that point. And that's why I'm saying that if we had a national service program, people should be able to opt out of it, out of the military component of it, and instead spend that year working in a hospital, working in a group home, working for a piece of, working for any legitimate nonprofit organization.
Right. Well, and if you looked at Vietnam, if you didn't have stop loss like we do now, the benefit of an all-volunteer army is if you have a 10-year, 12-year unpopular war in a democracy, if you can't, if it's not popular enough to raise the army, you can't fight the war.
Exactly. And that's the whole thing. If we had a draft right now, we would have been, we, first of all, we never would have gone into Iraq. Or if we had, we wouldn't have been there more than a year. I'm telling you, things would be completely different if we had a draft. Rich, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Dave in South Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, big fan. Great show again today. Listen, a couple of quick points. One, you seem to be completely against a standing army. And Washington wanted a continental standing army. We needed one during 1812. Our militias got brushed aside by the British. And right. Even at the beginning of the American Civil War, or Lincoln called out to federalize all the troops, a militia just cannot stand anymore. The systems are just too complex for a weekend warrior to be expected to command an F-16.
It works fine for Israel. It works fine for Switzerland. Why wouldn't it work for us?
Because our systems are much more complex, and we have a much further reach across the seas.
If we're going to try and maintain an empire around the world, yeah. But again, I would submit to you that, you know, we've got over 100 bases, 130 bases all around the world. We're projecting empire, and we're spending more protecting the oil that we import into the United States than the cost of the oil that we import into the United States. I mean, I think a lot of Americans, if their sons and daughters were involved in that involuntarily, they may be asking some serious questions that right now they're not asking, because basically it is what Jefferson referred to as the pauper hirelings who are being, you know, who are being willing to be shot at for a sixpence, who are doing that work.
Senator Kerry also made a joke about that, and he was right. He was right. You have a choice. You can either be a college student, or if you're broke, you're going to wind up in the military. I agree. I'm not against volunteerism. I think volunteerism is in this country should be expanded. I'm not even against putting making it mandatory.
Yeah.
I just think a standing army is a necessary evil for.
Okay, yeah. Dave, yeah, at the time, Jefferson was arguing that we should have a standing navy to protect our borders and not a standing army. He wanted a militia.
The Constitution, the Chesapeake, and all the
right.
One other quick comment.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see about that elderly librarian that was kicked away from Senator McCain?
Yeah, yeah. And it turns out that the building actually is private property. It was built in part with city funds. But the larger issue, I think, and frankly, you know, is how much damage is this going to do to the McCain campaign? And are we seeing the early stages of what we saw in the 2004 Bush campaign, where they actually go out in the parking lot like they did with the Colorado 3 and or the Denver 3 or whatever it was, and find people who have anti-McCain bumper stickers in their car and then come in and drag them out of events? Dave, thanks for raising. Yeah, as I said, this is going to be a very, very interesting election season. Mike in Seattle listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how you doing? First off, I'd like to take a second and thank you for your writing and advocacy for those of us who have ADD and ADHD.
You're welcome.
That's some great stuff. I'm trying to get my ex to get my kid off meds. I mean, you know, it's really great. But I wanted to address this idea of national service. Have you ever read Heinlein's novel Starship Trooper?
I don't think so. I read a lot of Heinlein when I was a kid.
Okay,
it's a little
jingoistic and all that. But Heinlein postulates the theory that if you want to be a franchised citizen, you got to give the country some time.
Right. Well, that's basically what I'm saying, we get a lot of benefits.
I really think I gave this country 6 years of my life back between 75 and 80. I trundled around Germany in a tank for 3 years and all that good stuff. And I really think, you know, you want to be a citizen, you want to be part of the program, give the country some time.
Yeah, there are incredible benefits. We are so lucky to be Americans. You especially get it when you go to some place like in March when we did our show here from Darfur, and you go to southern Sudan and you see people who simply by accident of birth literally have literally never in their lives seen a light bulb. and you know, have no access to clean water. I mean, we are so blessed in this country. And and I absolutely agree with you, Mike. And thank you for saying it. You said it so well. Along with that comes an obligation of citizenship of types. Wayne, I don't see the city that you're in, Wayne. Where are you calling from?
Connecticut.
Ah, Connecticut. Okay, great. What's up?
Hey,
Oh, Wayne, I'm sorry. I missed the time break, too. It's a wild day. Can you hold on for a second? We'll pick you up on the other side of the break. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program here on Air America Radio. Check it out, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. AirAmerica.com/TomVision if you want to see the show. Air America, let's see, what is it? TomRadio.com or something like that? Anyhow, AirAmerica.com, you'll check.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Spanish, Hindi, and Dolphin, just so I could relate. I'm exhausted from taxing and spending and controlling the media and hiding my agenda and ruling San Francisco as a separatist nation state. And in yoga today, I got bent out of shape because the guy doing bowl pulling poses next to me was intolerant. I hate to know how hard it is to be a liberal.
It is so tough. It is so tough. Good on you, Roy Zimmerman. Welcome back, 9.5 minutes before the hour, and John McCain is at it again. Busting, you know, we're supposed to have this embargo against Iran, right? Don't sell anything to Iran. But we are selling something to Iran, cigarettes.
We've learned that the exports to Iran increased by tenfold during the Bush administration. The biggest export was cigarettes, given that the, supposedly that the...
Maybe that's a way of killing them. I meant that as a joke.
Joke, yeah. Maybe that's a way of killing them. Yeah, well, that's now that's our con alert for the day. You want to get go from that to the downright crazy.
Crazy.
Here, would you like some torture with your snack on the airline? I'm not making this up. This is from the Washington Times, the Mooney Control Washington Times, the only newspaper they read in the White House. In fact, its title: "Want some torture with your peanuts?" Senior government official, U.S. Department of Homeland Security, expressed great interest in a safety bracelet. Instead of getting a boarding pass when you go to the airline, when you go to the airport, they give you a bracelet. It contains personal information. It can be scanned from a distance. They can monitor your whereabouts because it has a GPS device in it. And here's the kicker. If you misbehave, it can shock you. Yes, the DHS even has a nice little promo video of it. That you can see over at, actually, the Washington Times, you can see it.
It starts here, when passengers are issued their tickets. At that time, they can also be fitted with a special electronic ID bracelet that they will wear until they disembark the flight at their destination. These electronic coded bracelets will make traveling much more convenient for the public.
Oh, yes.
It will replace the need to carry a ticket containing all pertinent passenger information. In addition, the bracelet could permit tracking of the passenger through the terminal, including carry-on luggage.
And look out, Larry Craig!
Checked luggage can be coded to match the bracelet to ensure no tampering or diversions.
Oh, that's nice.
By further equipping each bracelet with EMD technology, the bracelets will allow crew members using radio frequency transmitters to quickly and effectively subdue hijackers.
EMD stands for electromuscular disruption. Shock therapy.
The electromuscular disruption signal overrides the attacker's central nervous system and will render even the most elite and aggressive terrorist completely immobile for several minutes.
Yeah, so this is the future of airline travel, apparently, in the minds of the Department of Homeland Security. Welcome to the brave new world. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Frank in Phoenix, listen. Hey, Frank, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Good to talk with you. Just a little background so you know where I'm coming from. I am a anti-this-war paleo-conservative. I disagree with virtually everything that Jonah Goldberg has to say, but I have to agree with him on this. I would refer you, you're probably aware of it. For some strange reason, the book The Minuteman by Gary Hart about 10 years ago came out and petered out. Basically, Senator Gary Hart argued for the militia-based national
defense. Right, I recall.
Now you can buy them for a dime a dozen on Amazon, right. And I think it's a very important book.
It sounds like you're agreeing with me, not with Jonah, because Jonah Goldberg is saying, no, there should be no national service whatsoever.
No. I'm trying to distinguish between the two. I think that every able-bodied male has a moral and, indeed, probably a legal obligation, it should be legal anyhow, an obligation to come to the defense of the country. My concern with the draft is the thing that Jonah Goldberg was talking about as far as how, you know, we had a draft in Korea, we had a draft in Vietnam, and neither of those conflicts posed any interest or any danger to the United States at all. We were doing that for global empire, anti-communism and so forth. The problem is that when you start to say, you talk about giving back to the country, you know, every 2 weeks I give back. It's the pay, when I get my pay stub and I see how much is taken out in taxes, that's where I'm giving back. I'm an honest, hardworking American.
That's buying services. I mean, that's, you're getting services in exchange for that.
Well,
I'm talking about the right of citizenship itself.
I think you're a citizen by virtue of the fact you're born here. And I do, again, I would say that...
I would say that accident of birth has responsibilities associated with it.
And those responsibilities should extend to the defense of the country. In Switzerland...
I don't disagree. And to carry it out, what you're I think perhaps what we're agreeing on here, Frank, is I would not be opposed to a more militarily oriented national conscription service if it was nothing but local militias.
Right.
And the local militias...
In Switzerland, they even have a thing, they have a provision in Switzerland where if you're a conscientious objector, you still have to serve in the medical corps.
That's right.
There's no two ways about it.
That's right. You're part of defending your country. I have no problem with that. But that's not how our military is set up right now.
The way that
our military is set up right now, I think it's imperative that people be given the choice between the two.
We would require a huge philosophical sea change of America. You know, you can't have a militia that's defending empire.
Right. Well, and as Jefferson pointed out, I mean, when he was president, he tried to get this passed. When he came into office, when Adams left office, there was over 300,000 men in the army. When Jefferson left office, there was about 6,000. Now, there are, you know, and then you had the War of 1812, and many suggested that was Jefferson's fault, you know, that he had drawn down the army. He was trying to build up the militia at the same time, and in 1805 tried to get it through Congress. It failed by one vote. So, you know, bad strategy on Jefferson's part. It didn't work out, but Frank, I think I'm with you on this. So anyway, we'll continue with this and other topics about the fate of our nation as Howard Ruff, the guy that I used to read back in the 1970s, comes on the program and tells us about the coming Great Depression. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Helping you win the water cooler wars.
This is Tom Hartman. Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
The True People's Radio.
This is Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Back in the 1970s, I subscribed for several years to a newsletter called The Ruff Times. RUFF. It was published by Howard Ruff. I read several books he wrote. As I recall, he wrote one called How to Survive a Famine or something close to it. Howard, was that the title?
That was How to Prosper During the Coming Bad Years.
No, but you had it, which you've republished now and added in the 21st century. I remember reading that in like 78. But didn't you have another book, too, that talked about things that you could eat, you know, wild edible plants and stuff like that?
Well, I had my first book I self-published, which was a lousy book, was...
I liked that.
Starting Famine and Survival in America.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not diminishing it at all. I actually thought it was a damn good book.
Well, I'm diminishing it. I thought it was a crummy book.
Okay.
Kind of more like Scream in the Night than a good argument.
Well, in any case, and I got to say, I bought gold at $500 or $600 an ounce back in the... It's... Not a good time. Why? You've got your book, number one New York Times best-selling author, Howard J. Ruff, is with us, and the former publisher of the Ruff, well, actually current publisher of the Ruff Times, and his new book, which is actually a reprint, updated for today, but a reprint of your 1978 book, How to Prosper During the Coming Bad Years in the 21st Century. Howard Ruff, welcome to the show, first of all.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for being with us. It was the most read financial news advisory newsletter in the world in its day. 600,000 subscribers. Rough Times, RUFFTimes.com, of course, is the website. I'm reading John K. Galbraith just published a piece recently called the Republicans' December Surprise, the coming December Surprise, suggesting that the Republicans have basically fooled the Democrats into getting in on this thing with them of, you know, throwing these $600 rebate checks out and, you know, bailing out people with bad loans and whatnot in order to stave off this coming collapse so that it'll end up in the lap of the next president, who may well be Barack Obama, and that would mean that, you know, he'll become the Herbert Hoover of his generation. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first place, they're all looking at the wrong problem. Everybody's worried about possibly the economy falling apart a la the 1930s. That's not the problem we face. The general's always fighting the last war. The problem we face in the future is inflation and even hyperinflation.
Right, it's more like Germany in the 20s, isn't it?
Yeah. Like Germany in the 20s. We don't know whether it'll be that bad or not, but it's going to be the worst inflation we've ever seen in America.
Right. And I know probably politically our perspective is a little different. You and Ravi Batra actually are both saying many of the exact same things. He's a regular on our show, the economist from Southern Methodist University, although he's recommending, you know, increasing demand and as a way of fixing the problem of the imbalance between demand and productivity. In other words, increasing minimum wages, re-empowering labor. Your solutions tend to be a little more libertarian politically. But what's the individual to do, in your opinion, Howard Ruff?
Well, you've got two steps you have to take. One is defensive. So if you're going to be having hyperinflation, that means the price of everything is going up, right, like it is today.
Yeah, or arguably you could flip that around and say the value of everything is going down.
That's right. Arguably the value, and in fact that is accurate. The value of everything is going down, but prices, which was the way we measure that, are going up.
Or the value of the dollar is going down, so prices go up.
So I suggest that when you go to the store, if you're going to buy one thing, you buy five or six of them and store them. You'll be buying it at these prices and consuming at higher prices later on. And that means a good investment. That's the first step. And I'm not just talking about food. I'm talking about all the commodities you buy and use on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing to do, if you have money, is to invest in inflation. Like Will Rogers said, invest in inflation. That's the only thing that's going up.
Right.
Well, a lot of people don't realize that.
That's commodities, basically, right?
Pardon?
That's commodities, right?
Well, not all commodities. The best, some of them you couldn't buy because some of the commodities, the futures contracts, that, you know, they dump a huge truckload of copper on your front porch. You don't want that.
Right.
But some commodities are concentrated enough in value, and that's gold and silver. Also, gold and silver mining stocks, oil service stocks, uranium stocks. I like all those things. They're investing in inflation. Because what it really boils down to is that maybe once in a lifetime, you have an opportunity when a major trend is in its early stages as it is now, when you can turn small amounts of money, of paper dollars, into genuine wealth.
Mm-hmm. So are you suggesting that, I mean, we're seeing oil, Osama bin Laden back literally 10 years ago to this month said that he wanted to see oil at $144 a barrel, and surprise, last week it was $144 a barrel. There's all this sturm and drang in Congress about, oh, this is just manipulators and speculators and blah, blah, blah. And then, of course, there's folks saying this is peak oil, this is the natural consequence. Are you suggesting that this is just the beginning?
Yes,
I think that the dollar, the collapse of the dollar, actually has a lot to do with it.
Yes, I am. And the and in fact, the price of gasoline today is, and the price of a barrel of oil is merely a reflection of inflation. The dollar is decreasing in value, so the producers want more dollars for their product. It's that simple.
Right.
And that's the real cause of it. And the inflation's all around us. I mean, eggs are up 30%. Wheat and corn is going up sharply. And, of course, we all know about the gas pump. So Congress is looking at the wrong problem.
But, you know, Paul Krugman in a column recently pointed out that there's no futures market in iron ore. And for whatever reason, I don't recall why. And he said there's also no inflation in that. In other words, arguing that it's all speculation. Are there anomalies in the commodities area?
Well, Paul Krugman's opinion on this stuff is a bunch of crapola.
Okay. All right.
Do you want me to tell you what I really think?
Sure. Yeah. Well, politically, what are the solutions that you'd look at? We're talking with Howard Ruff, by the way.
Well, I'm in the business of political solutions.
Okay.
I'm not smart enough for that. My job is for the middle class investor or the middle class person, maybe who hasn't even invested before. That's who I write for. And that, I'm not writing for Wall Street. I'm not writing to solve problems on a national level. I'm just saying, here is what is likely to happen, and here is what you ought to do in your life and with your money. That's my game.
Right. Now, there are two schools of thought on mortgages, for example. One is you want to be mortgaged up to the hilt so that you have as much available cash as possible that you can use to buy commodities, for example, gold or gold stocks, because they're going to go up faster than the real estate is. And the government subsidizes mortgage debt in the form of a deduction. The other is pay off your house as fast as you can. You don't want to have any debt. What are your thoughts on debt?
Well, you should do one or the other. Either having no debt on your house or having debt up to the hilt is really an aggressive way to do it. Like, for example, I borrowed $250,000 from against my home, which was free and clear.
Mm-hmm.
I then put half of the money into Canadian Oil Income Trusts, which have some special tax benefits in Canada, and the interest is 12%. That's what they pay. And that serviced my mortgage. That left me with the other half of the money available to invest. And my portfolio, along the lines of the things I'm suggesting, is up $90,000. Now, the value of my home in the real estate collapse is down $50,000. But I'm $40,000 ahead of the game.
Right. Well, that's interesting. So do one or the other. But if your home is, if you've got it half paid off, then
you're in trouble. That's a dangerous thing to do. I was just talking to my daughter, and she's starting to make extra equity payments on her home.
Mm-hmm.
No. Equity is a shrinking asset.
Right.
And it's your equity in your home doesn't produce anything for you. It costs you money.
Right.
So I suggest that she set up a separate mortgage fund and put the money in it and invest it properly. And then if the time comes when you want to pay off your mortgage in full, do it.
That's fascinating. Howard Ruff, his new book, which is a rewrite of his old book from the 70s, but here we are back in the 70s, and updated, of course, for the modern times, How to Prosper During the Coming Bad Years in the 21st Century, Howard J. Ruff, rufftimes.com, the website. Howard, it's great to talk to you after reading your stuff for 30 years. Thanks a lot for coming on the program.
Hey, call me again.
Okay, good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, and tomhartman.com, airamerica.com, our website. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Where despair is not an option.
Get active.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
often we spend our time catching people doing things wrong, I think sometimes it's important to catch people doing things right, to say congratulations. Yeah, he's a jolly good fellow here. Scott McClellan speaking out.
When I went out and said that we did not torture, we adhere to our international treaties and so forth, I was relying on what information was being given to me. Now, looking back on that, I hold a very different view when I know today that we were engaged in waterboarding and some other harsh interrogation methods, and I would have never made those comments from the podium had I known exactly what was happening in some of those settings. Whether or not it was illegal is a matter for other people to address, but I could not say honestly today that this administration does not believe in torture, does not engage in torture. Now, people within the White House continue to believe that it's not tantamount to torture. I just hold a different view today on that subject.
Good on you, Scott McClellan. 22 minutes past the hour. Wayne in Connecticut. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, I just wonder how Obama's proposal with the service there, how could that possibly be considered slavery if you actually get a benefit, $4,000 tax credit for your $100 of service? You're getting paid for your service. How is that slavery?
That's a question you'd have to address to Jonah Goldberg. I don't even consider national service slavery. You know, right. Compulsory national service with no compensation.
Yeah, but neither do I, but it's just funny that it's slavery. It's not slavery. If you don't do the $100, you don't get the benefit.
Yeah. It's an interesting, good point, Wayne. Thank you very much, and well said. Madison in New York City. Hey, Madison.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm fine. What's up?
Well, I was wondering, how would you feel if the Republicans did rig the election in November 2008 and John McCain won? How do you think our country would react? Would they go with the scandal after all has been found out about the rigged election?
That's a very good question, Madison. I am hopeful that particularly given, and thank you for the call, I am hopeful given what we've learned from the 2000 and 2004 elections. And frankly, the 2002 and 2006 elections, you know, it was in 98 that suddenly the exit polls suddenly started going haywire. Exit polls are used as the gold standard all over the world. They're used by the UN. They're used by the Carter Center. They're used by others to verify the veracity of an election, the accuracy of an election. And they've never failed before. And all of a sudden in the United States, they started failing. And in part, obviously, it was because of, people manipulating the vote. And in part, it was because of people being disenfranchised. So they thought they voted, but their vote never got counted. They ended up, with these placebo ballots, these provisional ballots. I think what we need to do is wake up enough people to this. I mean, movies like Uncounted and there's a whole bunch of specials that have been done on this are really important. It's really important to wake people up about it. And Mark Crispin Miller's doing a great job informing people on this issue as well. We need to be waking up as many people as possible. It's real. That's real straightforward. As to what the response is going to be, I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. Chris in Vernon, New Jersey. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Howard Ruff, I really liked what he was talking about. And doesn't this all really go back to the Federal Reserve? I mean, you've been talking about all this stuff forever. And isn't that like the huge – I'm 25. I'm not that much into politics, but I'm starting to. And to me, the Federal Reserve and inflation is the biggest problem we're facing.
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Talking about it.
It does and it doesn't. Here, keep in mind, the Federal Reserve has one primary mandate, and that's to protect the banks, its member banks. I mean, the Federal Reserve is all about keeping its own banks intact, and they're going to do that first. They're not going to necessarily put the national interest first. And then secondarily, you find that the Fed chairmen typically have, their own longevity as a concern. In fact, this is something John Galbraith in his column, and I think in The Nation, pointed out. He's got this long chart going back, 100 years that whenever it's a Republican administration, the Fed chairmen always lower interest rates before the election to make the economy better. But the other thing that will drive inflation is things that will drive inflation now that we're no longer on a gold standard. Nixon took us off in 72, as I recall. The things that will drive inflation are anything that decrease the value of our dollar, the value of our nation, because all of the dollars out there divided by the value of the nation is the value of the dollar, or increase the number of dollars. And while the Fed has the ability to increase or decrease the number of dollars in circulation by varying the money supply, by varying interest rates to some extent, the Treasury also has that ability. The federal government also has that ability by borrowing money. And so by going into debt as badly, I mean, this is what happened with Vietnam. We went into debt massively with Vietnam, and then you add to that Lyndon Johnson's Great Society program, which was only a tiny fraction of the cost of Vietnam, but together, you know, he tried to have guns and butter, and what he ended up with was dumping all this inflation on Jimmy Carter. It gets wrung out of the system, you know, in the next generation.
Now,
and the same thing is happening now.
Now, there's a lot of money in circulation right now, and that's what I read. The dollar was devalued 41% since Bush was in office. Now,
yeah.
I understand Obama wants to get out of Iraq, and hopefully we will when he gets in office, or if he gets in office. But how is he going to do all of this stuff he wants to do with
to restore the integrity of the dollar? Yeah, to restore the integrity of the dollar, we have to do two things. We have to restore the integrity of the manufacturing base in the United States. We have to bring businesses back to the United States and cause us to be once again manufacturing products, which in my opinion means going back to a tariff-based trading system like we had for 200 years in this country. And secondly, we have to stop borrowing money. We have to have a balanced budget. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
Listen on my phone, they're sneaking and they're peeking, and I'm never quite alone. They're spying and they're prying, but I shouldn't be alarmed. They're only gonna do it to keep me safe from harm. They call it Homeland Security, so they can do the things they do. But I'm not feeling any safer. How about you?
34 minutes. Past the hour, and James Hagee, John Hagee rather, is at it. I mean, it's our What a Friend We Have in W award here.
What a friend we have in W.
Oh, he's so strong.
Upright, strong, and resolute.
God wanted him to be our president. You know?
God wished him to be our leader.
So the Supreme Court had to do it, of course.
The court could not but follow suit.
So anyhow, here's what's going on. John Hagee has had his lawyers contact YouTube and pull down 120 videos of him. John Hagee, who seems to be out there suggesting that there's some kind of international Jewish banking conspiracy to rule the world. Where have we heard this stuff before, you know? And maybe there needs to be a war in the Middle East that is going to bring about the end times. And absolutely strange stuff. And this, by the way, a week before his Christians United for Israel conference meets in Washington, where guess who is going to speak? Joe Lieberman.
So since my vote will not be needed, I'll just stay at home and pray.
Now, don't you wish all the Republicans would do that? Yeah. What a friend we have in WNJ. Mike in Seattle. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, you know, with this upcoming Karl Rove issue, not testifying before the judiciary, I've been calling John Conyers' office and other members, encouraging them to actually go after Bill Canary, subpoena him because
this was a suggestion that Don Siegelman made on this show a couple of weeks ago. Start at the bottom, do it like a mob prosecutor.
Well, interestingly enough, I called today, and they're now telling me that they are actually considering that. So
that's
great. You know, I would encourage your listeners to keep calling these guys and saying go after him, because I think that's the key. Bringing this guy down.
Yeah. So, excellent point, Mike. Thank you very much for calling and making it. Call the members of the Judiciary Committee, and it's not just, hey, let's hold Rove accountable. Because, you know, the fact of the matter is that Rove, pardon my sneeze there, Rove you know, he could tie this thing up forever, but Bill Canary, he can't claim executive privilege. Bill Canary, by the way, is the guy who was the campaign manager for the guy that Don Siegelman beat but didn't beat, the guy who Siegelman alleges stole the election, the gubernatorial election, Bob Riley. Bill Canary was his campaign manager. He's an old buddy of Karl Rove's, and his wife, Lyra Canary, was the federal prosecutor who prosecuted Don Siegelman. What a convenient little relationship there. It's actually totally bizarre. Jeff in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Jeff, you want to disagree with me? You go to the front of the line.
Yeah.
What's up?
I just heard your Gold commercial the other day about the dollar's been baked and everything. Yeah, and we're a debtor nation. We owe so much money and all that. Yet I keep hearing you talking about a national health care system, and we can't even afford Social Security in the next 15 years. It takes up a big part of our budget with Medicare and all that. Yet you want to bring us into more debt.
Jeff, you're concatenating myths here. Let's set aside Social Security for a moment. We can talk about that separately. First, let's talk about health care. You realize what percentage of all the health care dollars in the United States go to pay salaries of over $300,000, up to over $1 billion, and pay stockholder dividends in the United States?
Well, there's no law against that. There shouldn't be government.
There's absolutely no law against it, and there should be, and there used to be. I remember when I was growing up as a kid in Michigan, health insurance companies had to be nonprofit. Blue Cross Blue Shield was a not-for-profit corporation. There was none of that. Now it's about 25%. 25% of all the dollars in America that go into the healthcare system are ending up in the pockets of either an investor or a CEO. That's wrong. If we did away with that, if we replaced that with a not-for-profit system, whether it's administered by the states like Bernie Sanders suggests, or whether it's administered federally, a Medicare for All program, or a single-payer healthcare system, that 25% of revenue that is right now being sucked off by Bill Frist's buddies and people like his daddy, who became
sure
one of the richest people in America.
Massachusetts is
involving private corporations, private for-profit corporations in the program. That's why Mitt Romney put it together that way. It's more crony capitalism.
Well, I don't agree. I don't agree at all that in the concept of obscene profits, what right does the government have? You know, Jefferson would be ashamed of you trying to get government involved in something like that. And if you're going to quote Thomas Jefferson in the future, just remember he was against big government, and it's no concept in our Constitution.
Jefferson was absolutely in fit when Madison was president, and he vetoed the first veto that Madison exercised as president in 1809, and you can go back and track this down. His first veto was vetoing a bill that Congress passed to pay for the health and medical services and food of poor people in Washington, D.C. And the reason that Madison vetoed it was because it gave the money to a church. And he and Jefferson agreed with this. He said the federal government, being responsible for Washington, D.C., should set up its own agency. This should not be run through a church. So, no, I disagree. I think that Jefferson would be in favor of a national health care system, or at least one for Washington, D.C.
No, that was the
he was in the day.
The church and state. That's
yeah, it not... was. But at the same time, they were absolutely saying we should provide for those in need. But my point is that we've reached the point where healthcare isn't something where you can just go down to the local barber and he can attach a leech to your leg or periodically bleed you.
It's immoral for me to pay for someone's cancer that they got from smoking or whatever. I mean,
why is it immoral for me?
And you're making us.
Do you
as
understand
Americans,
how insurance
have to pay
works,
for
Jeff?
Everybody's healthcare and lifestyle choices.
Jeff,
and that's immoral.
No, I would argue that it is immoral for you to be that selfish. Do you understand how insurance works, what shared risk means?
It's not selfish. I can give to whatever charity I want. But
do you understand how insurance works, Jeff? Do you understand how insurance works?
Yes. I don't know how much.
Insurance only works truly and truly effectively works if you share what are potentially very large risks for a relatively small number of people over a very large base. In other words, if you can get 100,000 or 1 million people to buy life insurance and only a few hundred of them die, you can have an insurance system that works. You know, E.F. Stone built an empire doing this. And for insurance to work, you have to have this very large base. And if we're in an era, and we very much are, where none of us, there's probably about, I don't know, maybe 20, 30, 50,000 of us who could afford virtually any kind of sickness and pay for it, you know, just by writing a check. But the vast majority of Americans, if they get sick, they're wiped out. So if we live in an era where the cost of medical care is unlike it was in 1776, the cost of medical care is way beyond the means of any individual person, then it's only reasonable that we all have insurance against that cost. If the insurance, if for the insurance to work, it means that we all have to participate to share that risk, and that way we all get the lowest cost. That's the best thing for us and our society.
Encourage huge tax breaks and create an industry like Giuliani wanted versus create some kind of government-mandated health care that's insufficient and immoral.
You already have an industry, and it doesn't work.
Smoked their whole life or was fat because they chose to eat so much. It's immoral. And you're totally against.
Jeff, go to.
I can't believe you took something from Jefferson against law, separation of church and state as big government program.
In which he was supporting caring for the poor. My point is that if everybody has a stake in this, if everybody in the country had a stake in health care, then there would be more social pressure not to be obese, not to smoke, and to have, and there would be more government program. Right now, the incentive, the corporate incentive, is to force people to be fat. In fact, right now, we've got this program that the government is talking about let's test all our kids for whether or not they need to be on statin drugs. It's being promoted by the pharmaceutical companies. Why? Do you think it's because they're concerned about our health? No, it's because they want to make more money. This is wrong. We should be teaching our kids decent health and nutrition. Instead, we've got schools where they're selling Coca-Cola and vending machines, and they're selling giving away candy and corn syrup laced foods in the lines, and you wonder why we've got an obesity problem. It's because we don't have a national health care system. It's because we're not all in this together, Jeff.
I don't want the government interfering in business and freedoms. And just like it should.
So you don't want a government that will enforce the contracts of companies. If you and I decide to do business together, you don't want there to be a court system to enforce the contract.
Of course, I want there to be.
Oh, so you do want the government to interfere in business?
I'm not saying that. I want there to be law.
So you don't want the government to establish a stable currency to interfere in business with a stable currency.
I'm not trying to say I'm.
You don't want the government to provide an educated workforce for your business or my business.
But please, look at how inefficient like our government has been. Even
you don't like our socialist police departments.
It was not it. Look, in our
you don't like our socialist fire departments.
Excuse me.
You don't like our socialist public highways.
Now you're talking about local government. You're talking about state government. You know you're.
You don't like our socialist army.
Oh gosh. You can keep going into all these things like fire trucks. And
I am
that
saying these are the things that are the commons. I don't want the government building TVs or cars either, Jeff. These are the commons, and it's not a burden, Jeff. It's a responsibility of citizenship. If you're going to take the benefits of citizenship in this society, guess what? You get to pay for it, or you can leave. I mean, literally, love it or leave it. 45 minutes past the hour. Jeez, I can't believe I'm saying that to conservatives.
The Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman Radio Program brought to you by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors on our local stations. There's many, yes. Our national sponsors, and of course, in part by the Teamsters fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. Find out more at Teamster.org. 866-303-2270. Dave in Detroit, listening on WDTW. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Our friend from Florida, he really was jumping points, and he's missing the big point, which is it's not working. We have 60 million Americans without health care. We've got another 40 or 50 million Americans that are underinsured. We've got we're the only industrialized nation that does not supply or provide its people with health care or education for that matter. And I got to tell you, Tom, I'm so tired of hearing these Rush Limbaugh isms of socialism and the regulations like it'll hurt. We're tracking to have the top 1% own 50% of the wealth in the next 25 to 30 years. And, you know, I would say a dirty word would be corporatism, not socialism.
Yeah, good point, Dave. Well said. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Bia in Seattle. Hey, Bia.
Hi. Well, I'd just like to thank you for being on the air. Actually, I didn't know that progressive radio even existed until a few months ago, so I'm very glad you're there. And usually I agree with so much of what you say.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually agree about, I am glad that Joe Nacho from Quest did not consent to the eavesdropping that the Bush administration wanted. But, you know, in all fairness, he really did. I worked for Quest and in Seattle, and I believe that, and so many employees do believe that he needs to be in jail for stock fraud.
No, I'm not saying he doesn't. My point was that I'll bet that if there was a serious investigation of the CEOs of every single one of the telcos, that, you know, a prosecutor in all probability could find something on every single one of them. That you know, very few people get to that level without some you know, dirt under there. But, you know, what happened was Quest didn't get, as a result of saying no to the FISA stuff back in February of 2001, Quest did not get federal contracts. In fact, this is part of Nacho's defense that he was you know, buying and selling stock internally on the assumption that they were going to get these federal contracts. And then when they said no to the federal government, they didn't get the contracts, and that diminished the value of the company. Whereas the other companies who said, yeah, sure, we'll spy for you, by the way, give us some, you know, a few billion bucks in contracts that are unrelated to this, you know, defense contracts and whatnot, that everybody else got helped. So, you know, whether or not, you know, I don't want to defend Joe Nacho. I don't know the guy. I don't know all the details of his fraud, other than that he's claiming as part of his defense that it was his saying no to the government on this case that caused him to his stock to tank, and, you know, a lot of stockholders I know got hurt as well. But whether or not that's the case is almost irrelevant. The point is that he has said under oath and apparently has documentary evidence to back it up that it was in February of 2001, not in September, not after 9/11, but February of 2001, weeks after George Bush was sworn into office, after he was appointed by the Supreme Court as President of the United States, that he was asking to spy on Americans illegally, and the Quest said no.
Okay, because I have family in Denver, and I've got the paper from July of last year when they talked about overarching greed and that kind of thing. Mm. And it does say, starting January 2nd of 2001, he sold 196,000 shares, and on and on and on. I mean, we would go online, we could see it at work, you know, go online, and so, my God, he sold 196,000 shares, he sold 300,000 shares. Is somebody going to do anything? The stocks went from $50 a share down to less than a dollar. And even now, at one point, they went up to $10, back down to $5. Somebody like me who worked there for a long time, there goes your 401k.
Absolutely. I agree, Bia, and like I said, he might be the world's biggest crook. I don't know. But the point, my point is that I'm not here to deify Joe Nacho. My point is that in his testimony, he blew the lid on the fact that this was not post 9/11. And that's been the excuse of everybody. And I appreciate the call, Bia. That's been the excuse of everybody up to this point. Oh, we've got to sign on to this piece of this FISA reform legislation. We got to go along with this thing, yeah, because it's all post 9/11. And the Bushies, they were just hysterical. They were just scared. No, I'm sorry. They started spying on us as soon as he came into office. Keith in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Keith.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to ring in on the health care. We have, you're referring to Blue Cross. We have Highmark Blue Cross here, which is in Pittsburgh, trying to merge with Blue Cross out of Philadelphia, would make them one of the largest insurers in Pennsylvania. And I'm self-employed with a family of four. Our health care in June was $1,500 a month. July 1st, it went to $2,500 a month. I don't know how
you absorb the cost. How you can negotiate?
No, the only way you can, Keith, is to be a CEO for a healthcare company and be making a couple $100 million a year, and,
well, sure.
and then pay for it out of your own pocket. But you're absolutely right, and I thank you for pointing it out and for the call. By the way, just a quick heads up: this the FISA fight, the votes. McJoan posting, blogging over at Daily Kos. The Senate just rejected Dodd's amendment to strip Title II. That's the immunity provisions from the FISA bill. The vote was 32 in favor of stripping out the immunity to 66 in favor of rolling over and giving the telecom companies and the Bush administration everything they want. 66, which means, you know, all the Republicans and what, 15, 16 Democrats. Spector's amendment fails 37 to 61. Bingaman's, the last chance for sanity, that fails 42 to 56. The Senate is in recess until 2:15 Eastern time. Let's see, that would be about 20 minutes from now. In 20 minutes, the Senate will come back into session so that the Republicans can have their weekly lunch and toast the capitulating Dems in celebration. Then they'll come back and finish them off. Time to call the Senate. Go to callcongress.com, or callcongress.org, excuse me. We've got all the toll-free numbers that we've been able to find. You can call Capitol Hill, you can call your senator, and be sure to keep track of how your senator votes on this thing, on all of these amendments. This is a big deal. This is a really big deal. Coming up next, our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment. Stephen Cass from Discover Magazine. Is the air in New York City dangerous or healthy? And we'll continue with the news and your calls as well.
Tom Hartman.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Exposing the con in conservative.
This is Tom Hartman.
Well, writing in the Australian and New Zealand Journal of Psychiatry, Joshua Wolf and Robert Sallow of the Royal Children's Hospital say they found the first case. This is a 17-year-old man referred to the inpatient psychiatric unit at Children's Melbourne Hospital with what they're referring to as climate alarmist, climate change syndrome. It's incredible. Anyhow, you know, sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, sometimes you don't know even what the heck is going on. Sometimes everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Yeah, well, is everything you know wrong about what's going on in the air and the water and the changing climate and, you know, even what they're finding over in Australia? Stephen Cass is with us with Discover Magazine. He is the senior editor there, discovermagazine.com, is the website. Hey, Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me on.
Thank you. You did an investigation of the air and water and microwaves and bugs and everything else in New York City. And this is fascinating. What, as you say, your morning breath can have 500 types of oral bacteria living in your mouth.
Yeah.
I mean, we are surrounded by, and in fact, my understanding is that 10-1 is the ratio in the human body of foreign DNA to human DNA. In other words, 90% of the DNA in our body is not human DNA. It's our environment all around us as well.
Yeah, I mean, point about it that we live in a sea of bacteria. You know, people get very worried about this sometimes because when they hear bacteria, they think disease or flesh-eating bacteria or stuff like that. But most of the time, we live in this kind of happy world where, you know, bacteria have been the dominant life form on Earth since for billions of years, and they will continue to be the dominant life form on Earth for billions of years. And we're just kind of living in their worlds, and usually we don't bother each other very much.
And you, but in looking at the air in New York City, the thing that always concerned me, frankly, you know, walking around, I've probably spent 2 years cumulatively in the last 30 years in New York City, and spent a lot of time there. And, in fact, used to be a partner in a business base there. And it was all the car brakes. You know, car brakes, I don't know if they still are, but they used to be made out of asbestos. And the taxi drivers are like, you know, nuts. And they're constantly slamming on their brakes. And that blows all these asbestos particles into the air. And I just always assumed that New York City's air must be full of asbestos and must be really awful stuff.
Well, we tested for a whole bunch of things. I mean, there are some bad things about the air in a city and that you have these smogs and particulates. But I really, like you, thought, oh, my God, I must be breathing lead and arsenic and chromium, like, all the time because I'm in the city, I see all this traffic. And then when we actually did some testing, we really didn't find any of that. The two things we did find that are one of which is specific to maybe places like New York and one of which is probably specific to any city, the first of those is iron. So we found little tiny bits of iron in the air. And that was from the subway. When you're in the subway, you know, you've got the wheels on the tracks and the action of the motors and so on. Grinds off a little bit of iron that puts in the air, but at levels that didn't appear to be, you know, in any way remotely dangerous. And then when we came up
are they helpful if you absorb the stuff into your lungs? Does it get in your bloodstream and cure anemia? It's not organic iron.
No, it's just like little tiny particles, but they really appear to be too small to really, you know, do much damage. Or it's certainly not a concern that we were able to find that because we went and, you know, checked the EPA and stuff like this and didn't find any sort of worrying signs for it. And then when we come up out of the subway, then we saw something that is kind of probably every city would see, which is an elevated amount of calcium in the air, which is also a metal. And this comes from concrete, you know, car tires, you know, grinding on wheels, construction sites, and so on. There's a lot of calcium in concrete.
People walking on sidewalks.
Yeah, and that gets shed off into the air. But again, really not any kind of, I mean, just barely above detectable levels for our system. And so I was really kind of expecting to write this big or juicy article about, you know, all these horrible things in the air. And actually it was, well, you know, here's not so bad.
Well, one of the things I've noticed about New York, and I think it's, you know, its location on the seacoast, is there's almost always a good breeze blowing through the city. So maybe it just kind of keeps itself clean, you know, unlike, you know, L.A. that tends to be in a bowl sometimes.
I think that's true where you can get cities. And my hometown of Dublin also have that sort of basin effect where you get this horrible smog. But I think in general, actually, people often worry a great deal about outdoor air pollution. And many times, kind of the thing that creeps up on people and gets them is actually indoor air pollution, not just in the United States, but worldwide this isn't the case. And, and you know, we've seen examples of this with you know, the FEMA trailers having formaldehyde and so on. So sometimes it's what's in your home or in things that you can see just around you that are a problem, not the sort of the big bad city out your door.
Yeah, you talk about 0.03 of an ounce of dust from your pillow or your mattress could contain 19,000 little arachnid,
dust mites.
Dust mites. I mean, little eight-legged creatures that you're inhaling. I mean, it's
that's the kind of the high-end number. I mean, generally, what's actually in your pillow right now, and everybody has it, you know, unless you've gone to extreme, is maybe a few hundred. But still, that's enough to cause really severe problems for some people with asthma and other allergies, and because, you know, the mites, they eat skin cells, they like humid, damp places like your bed, and they shed their skin. They're like little crabs, you know, they molt and they shed skin, and also they poop, and which is known as frass, and that also can all add up in there. So everybody has it, but an increasing number of people find themselves really quite.
So replace your pillow every 6 months.
I'm sorry?
Replace your pillow every 6 months?
Unless you're allergic, I probably don't think you need to go that far. Generally speaking, a good wash, because as I say, they you know, good hot wash will kill these guys off. They like it at a certain temperature level.
Wash a pillow?
Maybe you can't wash the pillow, but generally if you wash your pillow cover, your pillowcase, that's gonna you know, keep them at bay. It's one of those things where you can't beat them. You just have to, you know, keep them at a level that's not bothering.
Now, one of the things I thought was interesting in the article here in Discover Magazine, and we're talking with Stephen Cass, the senior editor of Discover, is you were looking at the levels of bacteria, like on the handrails in the subways, and then you hit a water fountain in the park, and it went from 480 bacteria in the handrail to 200,000 at the water fountain. Was that the water in the water fountain? Was that around the water fountain, or was that the handle on the water fountain?
No, that was around the water fountain, and you know, that was... You know, it's not a perfect place for bacteria to live. You know, it's moist. It's got all these little crevices that they can hide out in. It's also, you know, a little out of doors. So most of that bacteria was, you know, happy environmental bacteria, not bugging anyone. But it was a place where they were happy to live. So maybe if you did get something that wasn't so great in terms of disease, that would also be happy to live there too. But yeah, it's a high number, but that just because it's a high number doesn't necessarily mean, you know, all our water fountains are you know, plague carriers and stuff like that. But yeah, it's the kind of place where, yeah, bacteria do like to hang out. So
isn't the flip side of this, Stephen Cass, isn't the flip side of this that if you go out in the forest and just look at one teaspoon full of dirt, you're going to find probably over a billion fungi, bacteria, viruses, you know, maybe billions of them, multiple billions?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And let's get back to what you were saying earlier, whereby, yeah, we're just surrounded by bacteria
and viruses
and
fungi.
And all kinds of stuff. And the point about it is that most of these organisms don't care about people. They just want to go on their lives. It's actually really bizarre subset of bacteria that like to cause disease and other sort of nasties. And generally speaking, it's more successful. You're a better bacteria if you don't cause disease, because then your host doesn't, you know, die or want to get rid of you in some way.
Right. So the bottom line of your article, what you found was that New York City is not such a dangerous place, at least bug-wise. There was a lot of EF, electronic frequency radiation, a lot of radio frequency radiation. Mm-hmm. But even that didn't seem to be too bizarre.
No, I mean, we expect to see, I mean, I think sometimes people get worried about cities because they think they must be dirty places and so on, or just bad places to live. Mm. But I think given that now most people on the planet these days now live in a city, I think it's good to know that, well, maybe cities are not such bad places to live in. You can be okay. I mean, yes, there are specific problems that you can have, but generally speaking, a city is a nice place to live.
Right, okay. Just wash your hands and take your antibiotics and shower 16 times a day and wear your rubber gloves. No, I'm pastiching it here. Stephen Cass, it's his new article in Discover Magazine, discovermagazine.com. And, of course, the magazine, you can buy it on the newsstand. Stephen, thanks for dropping by.
All right, thank you so much.
16 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270.
This is Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Your radio support group for We the People.
Number. Hey, Dave in Los Angeles, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I'm glad you brought up that situation with Quest and Joe Nachio. And I don't want to deify him or make him a saint or anything. I think you're absolutely right. You know, it should be some skepticism there. But more importantly, this case needs to be looked at for just the mechanisms. There's two mechanisms that the government uses here that are really at show in this case. One, the withholding or awarding a contract to a corporation to get it to fall in line.
Right.
I mean, this is really dangerous. The second, of course, is the prosecutors that we all know about. But this situation with Joe Nachio, should he be correct in what he says for his defense, that from what I understand, he was sitting in the Pentagon. The DOD had the contracts he was signing.
Right.
And the NSA came in and approached him on the illegal stuff. the wiretapping, which he said his lawyers, he couldn't do. At that point, when he got back to Denver, those contracts that he had signed had been canceled. And that hurt those shareholders as well as hurt Nacho, because he was banking on those contracts.
Right, and that's why, you know, the Justice Department should be investigating this. Obviously, they're not going to do that because Mukasey's all about trying to protect George Bush's butt. And Congress should be investigating it, and I'm surprised, well, maybe, I don't know, maybe Henry Waxman has got some investigation on this going. There's so many investigations between Waxman and Connors and O'Connor and Conyers that they're doing in Pat Leahy that it's hard to keep track of them all, but
the GAO.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there is so much fertile territory here. Let us hope and actually, you know, let us get involved and push the next administration, if it's an Obama administration. God forbid it would be a McCain administration.
Yeah, this thing parallels the Siegelman case.
Yep.
In a lot of ways.
Yep. This is all the corruption of justice in the United States. Well said, Dave.
Crony capitalism.
Yep, exactly.
And that lady that lost some money on the shares, you know, I did too. I used to work for WorldCom, which is even worse. They were getting contracts, government contracts, while they were bankrupt. Yeah. And I personally know friends who installed splitters, which is a highly unusual thing to do on a fiber line. You just don't do it. And when they came out, we were very suspect when the orders came out. And there was no other end for the connection, which is always on the order. So these were real interesting. We kind of knew what was going on at that point. But I will tell you that this situation needs to be looked into. They need to take a look at this. And as far as the shareholders go, I think there's actually a case there for a class action lawsuit against the government for the loss of value.
Yeah, I agree. And hopefully, Dave, you know, some good lawyer is listening. I would love to see this thing pursued in depth. Marion, thanks for the call. Marion Welton, Manor, Florida. Hey, Mary.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Just great.
I'm calling about the FISA issue, and I just wanted to let you know that I was talking to my senator's office a few minutes ago, and I talked to a staffer who really disappointed me. I asked how the senator was going to vote, and he gave me the spiel that...
Senator was this?
Senator Bill Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
And the staffer said that he was voting for all the amendments to... he implied that he was voting for all the amendments to strip the immunity clause.
Yeah, he probably did. Most of the Democrats did, but that's a fig leaf.
Right. And then he said, but he's ultimately going to vote for the bill. And I said, well, I hope you're aware that there is a movement growing online. There's at least 22,000 right now on Obama's site that are going to hold everyone who voted for this thing accountable, and their reelection will be up for grabs. And I mentioned the August 8th mass donation date. Can I mention a website?
Sure.
FireDogLake.com. FireDogLake.com is organizing this thing, and apparently they're taking promises right now from people. And then if you on August 8th, everybody goes en masse online to make their donation, and it's going to fund contributions for those people we can vote for who support civil rights and support the Constitution. And the staffer took my information down, and I could tell he was kind of, well, you know, this isn't going to get me much credence with the senator, so I don't even know if he'll pass my comments along to him. But
right.
I'm very disappointed in Senator Nelson.
Yeah. Christy Harden-Smith over at Fire Dog Lake is doing a great job and with this whole thing in Jane Hampshire. Mary, thank you.
Thank you
for the heads up, and thanks for making the phone call and for you know, reporting back. This is frankly very disheartening. I just have no other way to infuriating, frankly, and I'm really torn about how to respond to this. And I'm going to not say anything imprudent or go off half cocked on this today. but this is a betrayal. I will say this. This is a betrayal of the United States of America, of the values of this country, of the Democratic Party, and of the people who care about and believe in this country. Right, left, Democrat, Republican, I don't care. This is a betrayal. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Give us a call at 866-303-2270.
Are out there.
Have you seen the crooked figures in the starched white sheds? You will find the crooked figures stirring up the dead. Always have clean sheds to play around.
Oh, really? The Abu Dhabi Investment Council has just bought the Chrysler Building. You know, this is after putting $7.5 billion into Citigroup back last November, but they're really not the piggies because they're just sitting on the money that we gave them because we have an insane energy policy because when Ronald Reagan came into office, he said about Jimmy Carter's policy, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to roll back those tax credits. We're going to roll back those rules. We're going to roll back those laws. We're going to take the solar panels off the roof of the White House, and we're going to do the good Republican economics of becoming dependent upon foreign oil and exporting all of our jobs overseas and destroying the American middle class. So I guess the real piggies here are the, you know, this recession brought to you by the Republican National Committee. 1-866-303-2270, our phone number. Peter in Boca Raton. Hey, Peter.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's up?
I wanted to share with you my experience being a, hold on.
Bean, hold on.
Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, you were on speaker.
When
I was 18, I was able to volunteer for the draft.
Mm. You volunteered for the draft? You mean you volunteered instead of getting drafted?
No, I volunteered to be drafted. You were allowed to volunteer for the 2-year draft if you wished to push your number up.
Oh, interesting. I didn't realize that.
Yes. I didn't want to go in for 3 years. I wanted to go in for two.
Uh-huh.
The big thing was that I was about 18 then and moving around from job to job, and what that service did for me is it made it possible for me to understand that I could actually stay one place for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned something even more valuable because the people who were in the service were of all different kinds of backgrounds. I didn't get locked into any kind of a class situation or a particular ethnic situation. There was all kinds of people there. In fact, my wife eventually led me to a PhD after that, where I don't think I ever would have gone to college even if I had not had that experience.
Yeah.
And listening to what you had said earlier, I'm all in favor of some mandatory service to the country, not just one service, like a military service or a hospital service, but perhaps a variety of services, but mandatory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thank you very much for sharing your experience with us, Peter. I agree, and I didn't have that experience, but I've seen that with many people, and, you know, that I just think that some sort of a give back to your country, and in exchange for that, frankly, I think that we should have absolutely free education, all the way up to the PhD, like pretty much every other industrialized country in the world does. You give something back to your country gives something back to you. It seems to me like an absolutely reasonable swap. John in Lafayette, Colorado. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hi there, Tom. A longtime listener, and I've learned so much from you through your show.
Well, thank you, and thank you for listening to us online, I guess, live.
Yeah. I wanted to look into this question of the morality of paying for somebody else's health care, and mm-hmm. particularly if that person has not taken great care of their own health, the caller who called a few minutes ago. I know a person who has had health problems who's taken pretty good care of his health, and I think that there are people who eat right and exercise and get cancer because they live, you know, maybe from pollution. Who knows what the causes are, but, you know, lots of people get cancer who take good care of themselves.
Right.
And there are people who don't take good care of themselves who don't have problems at all, but this idea of punishing somebody, you know, because they've smoked cigarettes or are overweight, I don't know, that just seems immoral to me. And then, you know, I think ultimately if a person is smoking or is overweight, they may be stressed about the health care costs that they may have, or they may be stressed
sure.
about lots of things.
Ironically, you know, I think the bottom line here, John, is that we do live in a world of social pressure. I mean, social pressures surround us all the time, you know, from childhood through adulthood and you know, in a whole variety of mostly very subtle ways. But, you know, from how we dress to how we behave to how we talk to each other to you know, how we conduct ourselves politically. And I would submit to you that if we were all collectively paying for all of our health care and we were all equally aware of it, that those habits that are expensive ultimately for all of us would become less socially acceptable. And right now there is no or very little stigma associated with them. You know, hey, yeah, you want to smoke? Yeah, that's freedom, you know. Because we're not all paying the cost of it. And so I don't think that you need, you know, draconian things. I don't think that you need to have people wear, you know, stars or badges or, you know, brand their forehead or something to say, oh, this person's a smoker. I mean, it doesn't need to be really severe. I think it just happens organically once everybody's, you know, involved in it. I mean, look at when I was in Denmark, a third of all the people in Copenhagen ride their bicycle to work. 30% of all people who are employed in Copenhagen ride their bicycle to work.
Wow.
And one of the most common things that I heard from people, we didn't see any people who were obese when we were there. We saw one guy. And all the time, the entire week Louise and I were there, one of the common things that I heard from people, you know, you say, oh, you ride your bicycle to work. How far is it? Oh, it's about a mile or it's 2 miles or whatever. It's very convenient because they actually have like separate parts of the street that are elevated an extra inch and a half. It's like separate streets just for bicycles.
Nice.
And on every street. And it's not just like a bike lane like we have here. I mean, it's a major, you know, very easy and very safe. And the major comment that I got from people was, I feel so much better.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
I'd like to make one more point, which is that he was saying that he thought it was immoral to pay for somebody else's health care. And, you know, ultimately he already is paying for those people now already. And he's not realizing that costs would go down. There'd be an increase in jobs. I think the whole thing is win-win. I don't know why people don't see that.
Yeah, well, they don't see it because there's a huge industry invested in making sure that they don't see it. John, thank you for the call. A huge industry, and they're funding think tanks, and they're funding advertising, and the whole bit. Laura in Portland. Hey, Laura.
Hi. How are you?
I am well. What's up?
I'm calling because, you know, I'm kind of concerned about and disappointed about Senator Obama's participation along with the rest of the Democrats in this FISA bill. And I don't want to make too much out of it, but what I thought was, at least for now, like a lot of people, I have that automatic donation every month for Senator Obama. I think for now I need to stop that.
Yeah.
Kind of rethink that because I don't feel given a free pass.
I think that that's an entirely appropriate response. And in fact, I have the same thing. And, you know, in all probability, well, let me think about this for 24 hours before I get totally nuts about this, because I'm so furious right now that I may I really want to be rational about this, and it's, I'm finding it very, very difficult. But I
absolutely. I'm not saying I'll never vote for him or something like that. But
yeah.
For right now,
yeah.
We can't.
On the one hand,
every month for
right.
You know a free pass.
Right. On the one hand, we can't afford to do circular firing squad. On the other hand, this isn't just some small issue. This is the friggin' Fourth Amendment.
Right. Well, because then we count on him to be a leader. And that's one of the greatest things about him was the whole thing with, you know, his leadership and ability to stand up on difficult things like Iraq. And
yeah.
So I guess I'm looking for at least a little more of a step in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, we'll see. We'll see what happens. Laura, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Derek in Miami. Hey, Derek, we got about a minute before the break. What's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
Just wanted to say, I watched Scarborough this morning. Just about all of the shows, MSNBC, ABC, they all spend numerous amounts of time talking about Obama said this, Obama forgot this, his plane went down. They rarely ever mention McCain. All the flop that he's done, all the misstatements,
oh, yeah.
All of his skewed
No,
plans.
And it's going to get worse, Derek. It's going to get worse because the interests of the huge multinational corporations and defense contractors who own our media are congruent with the interests of John McCain and to some extent anyway incongruent with the behavior, you know, with the suggestions that Barack Obama has made about how his presidency is going to be conducted. That's just the fundamental financial and tragically fundamental and financial reality is that we have a, and thank you for the call, Derek, we have a, not just a military industrial complex, we have a military industrial media government complex, and it has metastasized. It is a cancer on this democracy. 45 minutes past the hour. Talk radio news coming up next.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Time we think about same-sex parents, oh my gosh, we exclaim. I mean, to people who want to provide a protective and nurturing family environment, have they no shame? It's so deviant. The Lord's holy word, as my second wife said to my third, that a family's based on obligation and fear. We're defenders of marriage, connubial narcs, ever vigilant and patriotic patriarchs, defenders of marriage, defending the institution against people who want to get married.
Evening when my husband was doing laundry. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Oh, it's great to hear your voice again. How's everything going?
Everything's great. Thank you very much.
Good. So what's happening in the world? Has the final vote on FISA happened?
It has not happened as far as I'm aware. It is ongoing is my understanding of it. But I'm not as close to what is going on inside that esteemed building as I would like to be.
Mm-hmm. So what else is going on in the world?
Well, I can tell you what they're talking about in Washington, and they're not talking about anything that's going on these shores. They're talking about what's going on in the two countries that were both in the Axis of Evil, and that's Iraq and Iran. And they're talking about the candidate's response to the firing of the 9 missiles by Iran. Mm. And people in Washington are trying to figure out what Barack Obama and John McCain are talking about in their statements, in their response to the firing of these missiles by Iran, what John McCain means when he's talking about having a missile defense shield, what Barack Obama means when he says he wants to have unilateral as well as multilateral concessions. And they're trying to work that out. They're also absolutely, completely, and utterly exercised over al-Maliki's statement earlier in the week that he wants a timetable. Washington is flummoxed. The Republican Party has been thrown for a loop. John McCain is thrown for a loop. His
they thought they owned this guy. I mean, my recollection is that Maliki did is correct me if I'm wrong, Maliki didn't actually win the election. The previous guy won an election, I'm forgetting his name, and he stepped down or left town or ran off or something, and Maliki got promoted into that position by his peers in the parliament. Do I have that right?
Yes, you have that right.
Okay. So, you know, although the Republicans have been running around going, you know, yeah, this guy was democratically elected and he's our guy, and now he's saying, you know, Americans, thank you very much. See you later.
It's time for you to go. And, of course, right. Part of this is because Iran is telling him, hey, it's time for you to tell them it's time to go.
Right.
Because Iran would like to see the back of us also. He also has provincial elections coming up, and he would like to keep his gig. It's probably a fairly cushy gig, although it's pretty dangerous.
Well, and he doesn't want Sadr taking him down either.
He doesn't want Sadr taking him down. Sadr would like for us to go also. Basically, there aren't too many people who would like for us to stay. And rather than turning around and saying, wow, this is great, we can proclaim victory, let's go, for some reason the Republicans have decided to play this what seems to be all wrong and say, well, first of all, say, well, that's not what they said, it must be lost in translation, and then basically, effectively turn around and say, well, these effectively say this is not a sovereign government, they can't say that.
I think it was George Aiken, the former governor or senator from Vermont, who suggested to LBJ in 65 or thereabouts that he should simply declare victory and come home, or perhaps suggested it to Nixon, I forget which one. But I don't get it why the Republicans don't embrace this, and perhaps to some extent they are. I noticed there were a number of McCain surrogates on TV yesterday who were saying, oh, this is great news. This shows that the surge is working. See, the government's actually standing up. I mean, everybody's saying the surge isn't working because it's not providing room for there to be political change, and this is obvious political change if they're telling us to leave. And, you know, I'm getting whiplash from the different iterations of the Republican talking points in this thing.
One of the most insulting things that John McCain said was on Morning Joe on MSNBC when he was asked a question about this. And one of his replies when he was referring to Maliki was, he said, well, of course, he's a politician.
Like John McCain's not?
Exactly. One of the rudest things you can say about anybody, and basically saying, I think the sentence that follows that is to say, and therefore what he's saying is not true. I think that's the sentence that follows it.
Right. Or the we're not going to acknowledge or recognize it.
Exactly.
Has the State Department, there's been no official response to this yet, has there?
No, the State Department's initial response was to basically say that we're not sure that they actually said that.
Right.
That was their official response. That's what their spokesperson said.
And Ellen is reporting that from the Middle East, where the statement was actually made, that, or at least this is what she told us yesterday, that Maliki not only said we want a timetable, he also said we want to make sure that there will be no permanent American basis and no permanent American presence, period. Which, I mean, you know, we're spending billions right now building these 17 bases that are mini cities. I mean, some of them, I mean, the money that we're spending and the concrete that we're pouring over there, we could rebuild half our bridges, half our cities.
Yes, but that's a whole other thing, which we're not going to do with that money.
Right. I know, we're borrowing that money from China and from Abu Dhabi and in exchange giving them the Chrysler building. But the bottom line is that we seem to be planning on a long-term, you know, presence there, and they're telling us, no, you can't have that.
They're saying the best face that we can put on it is they're saying we want a timetable. We're not saying we want you on now. We're saying we do want you out, and it could be a few years. But we want a timetable, and without a timetable, you won't get a status of forces agreement, and you won't get a memorandum of understanding either. That's the other thing that they could have. The memorandum of understanding is the other kind of agreement that we
could
get.
These are the two ways that we can continue to maintain a legal presence once the UN mandate expires at the end of the year.
Precisely.
Fascinating. Well, it'll be really interesting to see, you know, how much pressure they can bring to bear on Mr. Maliki to change his tune. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging Bishop Harry Jackson, author of Truth in Black and White, about what he considers to be the voter's biggest dilemma, to vote religion or race, eh? And Tom Hayden, former California State Senator, longtime activist, SDS founder, is going to drop by and say hi. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you, activism begins with you. Ted, you're it! Get out there. Get active. See you tomorrow.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.